Sometimes judges misunderstand the assignment and go a little off topic.
Sometimes judges tell us that 10,000 monkeys with typewriters would probably eventually replicate the collected works of William Shakespeare.
What does this have to do with the case? We don't know, but that's what we're here to find out.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the OLR podcast. My name is Stephanie Katajimaki.
And my name is Devin Lamont.
And we are two associate editors on the Ottawa Law Review.
Today, we're taking a dive into the world of obiter dicta and some of the things that judges have said as sidebars in their judgments.
Obiter dicta is a Latin phrase meaning said in passing. We use it to describe the comments that judges often make in their judgments that don't necessarily pertain to the facts of the case at bar.
It can be hard to distinguish obiter from ratio. For those 1Ls out there, ratio is that rule about the case you need to remember going into exams.
With that, you might be wondering if obiter is binding like ratio is. The answer to that is not always clear. Traditionally, a case has only stood as authoritative and therefore binding for what it actually decides. This was expressed by the Earl of Halsbury, LC, back in 1901, and was echoed in R.V. Henry, a Supreme Court of Canada decision from 2005. Essentially, the court in R.V. Henry held that the further comments made in obiter move away from the ratio, the less authoritative weight they are given. Since then, we've heard more commentary on the extent to which obiter can be binding.
For example, in R.V. Procafue, Justice Doherty commented on the responsibility of lower courts to follow obiter from decisions at the Supreme Court of Canada. We know that lower courts are bound to the ratio of decisions at the Supreme Court, but Justice Doherty stresses that obiter need not be followed if there are compelling reasons for straying from it, like where following obiter would fail to preserve and promote certainty in the law.
Clear as mud? We think so too. You can read more about obiter in a recent OLR blog post called The Death of Obiter Dicta. But let's get into the actual cases we're here to discuss today. For this portion of the podcast, I'm going to read a quote from a decision that is full of obiter-esque comments. Then, Devin will give us his best-informed guess about what the case is about. We'll reveal the true substance of the decision after that. The first case we're going to talk about is R.V. Duncan, and this judgment comes from Justice O'Donnell.
Okay.
So, at paragraph 8, Justice O'Donnell says, "It has been said that given enough time, 10,000 monkeys with typewriters would probably eventually replicate the collected works of William Shakespeare. Sadly, when human beings are let loose with computers and internet access, their work product does not necessarily compare favorably to the aforementioned monkeys with typewriters." And in case you're confused about what typewriters, Shakespeare, or internet access is, Justice O'Donnell has included notes about what each of those items are.
Okay. That's a very interesting comment. Once again, for the viewers, I have no idea what this pertains to. I am just supposed to give my best educated guess. And I don't know, first reaction, this feels a bit like a boomer moment with the typewriters and the internet. But I honestly am not sure. Maybe he just has like a very strange fascination for monkeys with typewriters. And honestly, that's an interesting concept. That's... I can't even begin to imagine what the subject matter could have been that would have brought that perfect piece of obiter in the decision. So let me think. Definitely, okay, internet access has to do something with that. It has to do with maybe privacy, maybe some kind of software development. Well, I'm not going to get any hints, am I?
No, you're getting nothing from me on
that. That's great. No hints. Okay, you know what? I don't know what it is, but... I love the mental image conjured here, and honestly, this is quite an iconic obiter moment.
How about I read you paragraphs 1 to 4 of this judgment? Okay. Maybe that'll
maybe,
help.
Maybe, yeah, give me a little bit of a clue here.
Okay. "You should get out of town," the man said. "And so began the journey that resulted in my path intersecting with Matthew Duncan's path, and thence, to these reasons, with a slight detour through territory that might have confused Lewis Carroll. I suppose that I should clarify that there was no menace in the man's directive to me to get out of town. He was a friend and a colleague in two careers. His suggestion had been that he and I should change positions for a fortnight, giving him exposure to the realities of the northern reaches of Toronto, While I would enjoy a similar change of environment in the more sylvan environs of the Niagara region, I might even see a few plays in the evening, he pointed out. And thus, I came to meet Mr. Duncan.
Wow.
Anything from that?
It sounds like a classic Charles Dickens novel, the way he writes. This is very eloquent. I couldn't even begin to fathom what this is about, but I like the way it's written. Honestly, it sounds like the start of a really good novel that maybe I'd like to read.
It's a book I would read too.
Honestly, he sounds like a good storyteller, and it sounds like he's focusing a little bit more on this than maybe the decision. I'm okay with that. I'm all for it, honestly. Monkeys with typewriters, and anytime a judge drops the words thence and Fortnite in a decision, bring back old language. I like that.
And this case is actually from 2013, so it's not recent.
Oh, wow. Okay, I was picturing a case from maybe like 1955 based on the language. So, okay, that's very interesting. Well, you know what? The judge who drafted this decision, I like the way he speaks. I like the way this was drafted. It's very eloquent, and it makes me feel like I'm reading a novel. This is great, especially for law students who kind of get bored reading decisions. I feel like if you add a few comments like this, especially with the monkeys and the typewriters, that would help me focus a little bit and get me more engaged with the story. So anything that gets me more engaged with the decision, I'm all for it.
I'm glad you say that, because we have two more decisions from Justice O'Donnell.
Oh, great.
In this episode.
Okay, great. So he's known for these comments.
He really is.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about Mr. Duncan in this case. It's a Highway Traffic Act offense, and it led to a police-citizen interaction in a parking lot. This is still kind of obiter, but this will give you a picture of what this case is about.
Okay.
So at paragraph 5, we hear that, at heart, Mr. Duncan's case was unremarkable. A minor alleged Highway Traffic Act offense led to a police-citizen interaction in the parking lot of Mr. Duncan's apartment building in the wee hours of the morning. A request that Mr. Duncan produce his license led to an alleged refusal, which led to an attempt to arrest him, which led to a struggle, which was captured on a very poor quality video taken on a mobile phone, at the end of which Mr. Duncan found himself being placed under arrest for allegedly assaulting a police officer. Nothing unusual in all that. The bread and butter of provincial court. Of course, I hadn't counted on the free men of the land.
Okay, well, it sounds like a bad day for Mr. Duncan, perhaps an even worse day for the police officer who had to deal with Mr. Duncan. Connecting this with monkeys and typewriters.
No connection.
That's.
There is. So later on in the judgment, Justice O'Donnell also talks about how Mr. Duncan submitted an affidavit of truth in support of his claims.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that is a flattering comparison, an affidavit of truth.
Well, I mean, in one of the notes, though, Justice O'Donnell says that he does not mean in any way to compare Mr. Duncan to a monkey with typewriter.
Right. Okay. Well, I know.
He clears that.
I'm glad that he added that clarification, because it could very well be misconstrued. So that's a good one to start us off.
RV Duncan.
That's a strong obiter comment right there. I can't see why it wouldn't be binding. Obviously, it's so close to the decision, you know.
Yeah. Okay, next up, we have another Justice O'Donnell decision.
Great.
I love this guy. This one is called RV Tour.
Okay.
I'm going to go to a little bit later in the decision just to not give anything away this time.
All right.
So at paragraph 11, Justice O'Donnell says, the bottom line is that the extraterrestrial visitor on the Clapham Omnibus, the emblematic reasonable person in the history of our legal system, could never find a Section 11B violation here.
Okay. Wow, the strong obiter for our second go-round here. Extraterrestrials and Section 11 violations. I guess we're assuming that if extraterrestrials ever came to Earth, they'd be fascinated by our criminal law system and our charter rights. So I'd say that's a hot take, but...
What do you mean, if?
Oh, that's true. Oh. You know, we don't know, I guess, yeah. Could you read the last part of that again?
Of course. The emblematic reasonable person in the history of our legal system could never find a Section 11B violation here.
Okay. And we're comparing the reasonable person to an extraterrestrial.
Well, the extraterrestrial visitor is the reasonable person.
Right.
In this case, apparently.
Okay. Well, you know what? If we're comparing our constitutional law and our criminal law systems by galactic standards, I think I don't know how well they would fare. But you know what? If you go to some other places in the world, maybe it's not so bad. It's an interesting comment. I'm not sure where. I mean, obviously, it's a Section 11 violation, so I'm going to guess it had something to do with criminal law, constitutional law. I guess no hints, hey?
Well, let me give you paragraph 7, because Justice O'Donnell actually talks about our extraterrestrial visitors. So he says, if extraterrestrials were to visit Canada to study our criminal court system, or if they have already done so, it is probable that the two things most likely to perplex them would be our law's treatment of drink driving offenses and its treatment of Section 11B of the Charter. And then in brackets, aliens attending a trial in which both issues arose would probably run back to their ship and flee the galaxy forever.
Well then, I guess, yeah, not such a glowing review of how we deal with Section 11. Yeah, honestly, I love this fixation with extraterrestrials. I feel like this is something we need to explore more.
And it's a common theme.
Yeah, it clearly is. Having a fun theme for your judicial decision, I respect that. Like I said with the other Obiter comment, as a reader, as a student reading these judgments, it really does help me keep in it. So I appreciate that. And, you know, we can't stay in our little Canadian bubble here and just compare our system with how it used to be. We have to think of, well, you know, if an alien did come to Canada, what would they think of us?
What is their opinion on our court system?
Exactly. That's an opinion that we rarely talk about. And I think we need to talk about it more. I'm glad that the judge here brought it up. It's about time.
So this case, you're right, it's about an 11B violation, so challenging the case under Jordan.
Oh, Jordan on delays.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
They're saying it was too long of a delay. Yeah.
Okay.
We know Jordan.
I guess, yeah, no, aliens probably have the same commentary on, say, like our healthcare system, you know, with delays and all that, so.
I think my favorite part about this particular case is when Justice O'Donnell actually contemplates if there was a free seat on that alien bus, he might take it.
Yeah? Oh.
Yeah.
Go be a judge somewhere else in a galaxy far, far away. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the state of our law is quite so abysmal, but, you know, maybe it is.
Yeah. Even if at times I wonder if there might be a spare seat on that alien spaceship is exactly what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting case. Give it a read.
Yeah. Honestly, I'll have to give it a read. I'm also sensing like maybe the judge here just has kind of this deep-seated desire to explore the cosmos or something.
And maybe in space is where he's seeing those monkeys with typewriters.
That's where he gets all his ideas. He's been abducted.
Yeah. Once again, we have another Justice O'Donnell decision.
Oh, I love this guy so much. Okay.
It's our last one for this episode, though.
Oh,
so
sad.
Savor this one.
Yeah, I will.
So this case is RV Quirk. So I've got one little quote I'm going to give you. And then if you can't get it from that, which you probably can't get it from that, let me read you the first paragraph after that. Okay.
I've been so good at guessing with these last two.
Rounds,
so I'll do fine.
So from paragraphs 22 to paragraph 24, this is what Justice O'Donnell had to say. Sergeant Schultz would intone forcefully. I see nothing. I hear nothing. I know nothing, or some variation thereupon. Those utterances became a meme decades before the concept of a meme even entered popular culture. Coming from the mouth of the actor John Banner, those words came to be very amusing. Coming from the mouths of witnesses in a courtroom, not so much.
Mm. Okay, so we have finally an authoritative voice on memes now. Very interesting. So we're talking about probably courtroom etiquette here and what witnesses can say. Probably don't want to drop memes in the courtroom. What did he say was the meme again? Like the very start of that quote?
I see nothing. I hear nothing. I know nothing.
Mm. Okay. Interesting. An ideal witness, depending on what side you're on. So I guess not super helpful in the interests of justice for a witness to hear, see, and know nothing. But
do you know who Sergeant Schultz is?
I am not familiar with Sergeant Schultz. Please explain.
So Sergeant Schultz, as we hear in the decision, was a member of the Luftwaffe assigned to guard Allied aviators who were prisoners of war in a German Luftstellung during World War II.
Okay.
And he is a character from Hogan's Heroes.
Hogan's Heroes? I've heard of that.
I haven't.
I've heard of that somewhere. What was Sergeant Schultz's relevance to this?
Well, so Sergeant Schultz said, I see nothing, I hear nothing, I know nothing.
Mm. Quite an asset for the Allies then, I'd imagine, if he's the guard at this POW camp. Yeah, relating that to witnesses, I guess, yeah, that would not be an ideal witness, would it?
Well,
interesting analogy.
I mean, since you bring up witnesses, here's paragraph 3 from this decision. Sergeant Schultz, this is going to give us a picture of who he is.
Mm-hmm.
To be clear, was not a witness. He is not a member of the Niagara Regional Police Service. Indeed, he is not even a real person, as we just discussed.
Great. Well, then I'm glad that he brought him up then.
Right.
What this case is about. I'm going to guess something procedural. It was RV Quirk, you said?
RV Quirk.
Okay, so it's criminal law. Mm-hmm. Then, I don't know. I feel like this is going to pertain to something procedural then, if we're talking about witnesses being poor people on the stand and just not doing their job. So I'm going to guess it has something to do with criminal procedure. Maybe in the same vein as Jordan in the last one.
You're right on criminal.
Okay.
Not right on procedure.
Oh, dang it.
From Justice O'Donnell himself, in the very first paragraph, "The wee hours of the morning, a speeding car, a very brief vehicle and foot chase, the smell of alcohol on breath, defiance, resistance, a struggle, drink driving charges, allegations of excessive force and denial of access to counsel." Yeah.
This is great. I feel like if this was narrated by Morgan Freeman, this,
it'd be good.
It'd be great. You could totally make a whole movie out of this, just what he's writing here. I've noticed he likes to start his Obiter comments with "in the wee hours," because didn't he say that in the last one too?
Yeah.
All right. So drinking and driving offense. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I don't know. Maybe witnesses wanted to just not convict this guy and they wouldn't say anything. It sounds like the justice here is a little upset with that.
Essentially, yeah. The reference to Sergeant Schultz was kind of in the sense that we had witnesses that were just like Sergeant Schultz. Mm. They didn't see anything. They didn't hear anything. They weren't very helpful witnesses, if you will. So that was one of the things they were struggling with in the case, is the evidence of what was going on with.
Okay, I feel like I should get some points for procedure.
I'll give you points.
I should get some points then.
I'll give you points for that.
Okay.
So we're moving away from the criminal law cases now,
okay,
which means we're also moving away from Justice O'Donnell. Next up, we have two cases from Justice Quinn.
Okay.
So when you see that name, know you're in for a good decision.
Got it.
So the first case we have is Miller v. Carley. Just to sort of set the stage for this decision, at paragraph 210, Justice Quinn says, "During this trial, truth was only an occasional visitor."
Oh.
So take that into consideration.
Okay, that's oddly poetic.
So this one might be a bit of a giveaway because his obiter comes out strong from the beginning and it really tells you what the case is about. So an easy one.
I need an easy one after my performance so far. So
this is paragraphs 1-3. "After a busy day conducting illegal drug transactions, the plaintiff, the defendant, and a mutual friend stopped at a corner store where the defendant purchased some scratch lottery tickets. One of the tickets proved to be a $5 million winner. The parties dispute ownership of the winning ticket. If the ticket were a child and the parties vying for custody, I would find them both unfit and bring in family and children's services. The case is a wash in untruths and curiosities. It is a study in good fortune squandered and generosity abused."
Again, this seems like a really good intro to a book. So,
it's a book I would read.
Honestly, yeah. All right, so we have the plaintiff, the defendant, someone else dealing drugs, as you do, you know, hard day's work dealing drugs. And then they go out and get a scratch ticket, and then they're squabbling over the ticket.
Yes.
And if they were vying for child support, they would all be unfit. I would hope they would be unfit, considering that they're dealing drugs, but I don't know if that's what the justice zeroed in on here. On that point, I would probably agree. Okay, let me think. I don't know. Maybe the plaintiff just like punched the defendant in the face or something to get the scratch ticket and ran with it. That's what I'm thinking.
You're overthinking.
Really?
You're overthinking this, Devin.
Well, it has to have something to do with drug dealing, because if that's part of the case, it has to be a drug case, right?
It's civil, though. Remember, we're not doing.
Oh, right.
We're
no,
out
you're
of
right.
The, we're out you're of right. Criminal
we're out of. We're out of. Okay. So maybe. Okay. This is. I feel like this is probably a common thing. One person paid for the ticket. The other person scratched the ticket. Who gets the money, right? Is that maybe what it's about?
That's exactly it.
Oh my God, I got it. Okay, finally.
So what happened was the plaintiff and the friend were both present when the defendant bought a lottery ticket.
Okay.
And then that lottery ticket went on to win $5
million. $5 million.
So now the plaintiff wants a piece of that $5 million. Mm. And the plaintiff says that he had given the defendant $10 for the purchase of the ticket. So...
Okay.
It's a very contested decision.
Yeah, I love that he just added in the extra fact of a hard day's work drug dealing. So
it was so relevant to the decision.
Yeah, honestly,
you think?
Yeah, it's just giving up us a little bit of context to help us visualize. So, well, yeah, I mean, if you paid $10, you should probably get part of the winnings, right?
No.
No, he didn't win.
The action was dismissed.
Oh wow. So, oh, maybe if it was given as a gift, though.
Oh, that's getting into property law.
Yeah.
Here.
Oh no, I haven't dealt with property law since 1L.
We're so, not going yeah. there, 1L. Sorry.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that is Miller and Carly.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I hope they're happy. Well,
glad he threw in a little fun fact there to introduce the story.
Trying that's to derail great. It.
Yeah.
Throw you off your game. So the next case, our last case of the day, is Bruni v. Bruni, which is also from Justice Quinn.
Okay.
Any initial thoughts?
All right. So maybe a family dispute. I'm guessing maybe husband, wife.
You're right about that.
Okay. All right.
It was a good guess. Let's get into what Justice Quinn had to say about Bruni and Bruni.
All right.
So this is actually a note that I'm going to read. It's a note added at the end from the case itself.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
At one point in the trial, I asked Catherine, if you could push a button and make Larry disappear from the face of the earth, would you push it? Her "I just won a lottery" smile implied the answer that I expected.
Wow. Okay. She really does not like her, I presume, ex-husband. So, I'm sensing like maybe a little bit of animosity in this relationship.
A little.
Just a little bit.
Well, Justice Quinn was fair in his assessments. He treated both parties equally here because in paragraph 11.
Did he?
Well, okay. In paragraph 11, Justice Quinn says, Catherine and Larry were married on October 7th, 1995. If only the wedding guests, who tinkled their wine glasses as encouragement for the traditional bussing of the bride and groom, could see the couple now. See note 3 below, and I'll give you note 3. I am prepared to certify a class action for the return of all wedding gifts.
Oh, wow. this must have been some breakup. Holy. Yeah, I know you gotta think about the wedding guests too, you know?
You pay
a lot of money to go to those
you
weddings.
Do. You do. They're know? Expensive Especially, these days.
And if you don't get a good wedding gift, you know, you might actually not talk to either of them for a while because they might get a little upset about that. What was it? A class action, you said?
A class action on behalf of for the return.
For okay. It's this must have been recent then. If
2010.
And oh, they were married in 1995?
They were married for a while.
Okay. Well, maybe I feel like what is that? 15 years.
15.
It's a little late to get your return on a wedding gift.
Yeah.
Maybe like a little late, but wedding gifts are expensive.
Yeah. So you're completely right about the substance of this case.
Okay.
I'll give you paragraph 2 because that's, you know, it explains the whole of the
right.
matter, essentially. This is yet another case that reveals the ineffectiveness of family court in a bitter custody/access dispute where the parties require therapeutic intervention rather than legal attention. Here, a husband and wife have been marinating in a mutual hatred so intense as to surely amount to a personality disorder requiring treatment.
What a beautiful word, marinating.
Marinating in a mutual hatred.
Mutual hatred, yeah.
15 years of it, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's marriage, right?
So apparently.
Yeah, yeah. That's solid Obiter. And this relationship must have been something else if he felt the need to say all of this. But, you know, maybe he, the justice, just said what the husband and wife could never say. So,
you know what? That's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe we should... thank Justice Quinn.
Yeah. And honestly, like I appreciate all seriousness. I do appreciate the comment on therapy rather than a focus on like the legality of mm-hmm. divorce and all that, because, you know, sometimes the whole counseling and everything that does not get enough attention. So
mm-hmm.
I get where he was going with that. I don't know if he needed to say they were marinating in mutual hatred, but I mean, maybe it needed to be said. Right. So in any event, I appreciate the justice's comments and. Yeah.
He included some other fun little tidbits, which
okay.
we might as well throw in here.
Yeah,
while
throw them
we're
in,
here.
Throw them in.
His very first paragraph, he starts it saying, paging Dr. Freud, paging Dr. Freud.
That's okay.
And?
All right. Not sure.
Is he here? Is he
yeah.
in the room?
Yeah, I guess. Well, I don't even know where to go with that one, but it sounds like he had fun with this decision.
It sounds like he did.
Yeah. At any rate, I appreciate the Obiter. These have been some fantastic comments.
These have been
and,
good.
Yeah, some great Obiter moments.
You did pretty good. You did good
yeah,
with your guesses.
Maybe towards the end, not
yeah.
so much. Not so much at the start.
You started off a little more difficult.
Yeah, you know.
But I think there's a lot to be said about taking some of these comments out of context. So I'd encourage everybody listening to go read the entire judgments.
I'm going to give myself some credit because most of these judgments are like 200 to 300 paragraphs long. So, and from an Obiter comment, I think I should get like a little bit of credit.
But, you get credit for it. You did great. Yeah,
definitely stronger at the end there.
Yeah, for sure. And with that, we've come to the end of today's episode of the OLR podcast.
We hope you had as much fun listening as we did chatting about monkeys with typewriters, aliens, Sergeant Schultz, scratch tickets, and Freudian family dynamics.
Next time you're reading a decision and read about something a little more out there than expected, think to yourself, is this going to be on my exam, or is this actually Obiter? We would also like to thank the OLR Podcast Committee for making this episode possible. Thanks for listening, and you'll hear us next time.